Today we're going to start with Solomon. Last time I mentioned that we were going to discuss Solomon today, which is a little bit slower pace than what we have been taking, so that we can stop and take the lay of the land in terms of time and books and, you know, in general timeline and what's about to happen. So let's discuss Solomon, and then we'll jump into that, and I'll give you an overview of what we're going to see in probably about the next 8 weeks as we finish up the Old Testament. So Solomon, the primary narratives of Solomon are 2 Kings 2 through 11 and 2 Chronicles, excuse me, that's 1 Kings 2 through 11 and then 2 Chronicles, that one is correct, 1 through 9. So the first thing is, remember last time we talked about wars of succession. Often when you have a change of power in the world, our world and their world, you're going to have bloodshed. David had a war on his hands. He had a son of Saul, Ishbosheth, that he had to contend with for the kingdom. Solomon almost had a war. Their blood had to be shed. People needed to be killed to keep that from happening, and that's exactly what happened. So the war of succession in this case, partially because of David's wisdom in giving Solomon advice, but also because Solomon himself was wise, ended the battles before they began. Okay? At the very beginning of the narrative, you've got essentially four problem people that you need to deal with. The biggest one is Adonijah. Adonijah was David's eldest living son. I think he was the fourth son, but all the others had died at this point. So Adonijah was the eldest living. Naturally, Adonijah would be king. That would generally be how they would think that this would work. But then again, that's how most monarchies work, but not necessarily the Israelite monarchy. Saul's son did not end up taking over. What would happen with David? So naturally, Adonijah sets himself up. If you read that bit of 1 Kings at the beginning, while David is still alive, bedridden, not really able to do much, but alive, Adonijah basically starts getting ready for his coronation. He goes and has a sacrifice, and he has the support of Abiathar, however you pronounce it, who is the priest. He has the support of Joab, who is the leader of the army. And if you're the oldest son, you have the leader of the army on your side, and you have the leader of the religious institution on your side. You're feeling pretty good about your chances in terms of taking over. This was not ultimately to be. David had intended for Solomon to take over, and he had said so. He might not have said that to everyone, so Adonijah or some of the others might not have even known that that was the intention. But that was David's intention. And so whenever the prophet and whenever Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, heard that Adonijah was preparing to take over, they went to David and talked to him about this, and David proclaimed, ultimately, Solomon king. Now, David told Solomon, Joab is a problem. Joab is a bit unscrupulous, having, in the words of the text, killed some people in a time of peace for things that were done in a time of war. In other words, the war was over, yet Joab took matters into his own hands and killed some people. In other words, Joab is a murderer. And so David says, you need to deal with Joab. I told Joab I would not harm him, but you need to deal with him. So that was David's advice. And then, of course, Abiathar, something needed to be done with him because he supported Adonijah. And Shimei, you might remember him, when David was running from Absalom, Shimei was cursing David as he was trying to get away. And David's like, you need to deal with Shimei. So what happens is Solomon gets crowned king. Adonijah's support melts away when they see this happen. And Adonijah, as the older brother, is now somewhat afraid. All of his companions are afraid because they just supported what they thought would be the king, but now he's not. And so all his support goes away. Adonijah goes, begs for his life, and he is, at this point, spared. However, Adonijah asks for something from Bathsheba. Do you remember what that is? Abishag, the Shunammite. Now, Abishag was essentially one of David's concubines. It was David's bed warmer. He was really old. They didn't have electric blankets. And so they had, as a king, they had a young lady sleep in his bed with him to keep him warm. Now, the text says they never had sex. And so in that sense, she wasn't like many concubines. But she had a very preferred place with the king. Now, if you remember your Samuel and your king's narratives, one of the common things to do if you want to take over is to get the previous king's wives and or concubines. Ishbosheth had the same problem with Abner. After Saul was dead, Abner took one of Saul's concubines, and Ishbosheth was rather upset by this. Absalom did the same thing. He took David's concubines and on the roof in front of everyone had sex with them as a show of, look who's in charge. I've got King David's concubines. This is a way of saying, I'm in charge now because look what I've done. When Adonijah comes to Bathsheba, this isn't just she's pretty and I want her as a wife. This is a potentially very dangerous move because he's asking for something that was King David's. Because of this, Solomon sees what he's asking and puts him to death. Joab then, fearful for his life, rightly so, goes and clings to the horns of the altar. That was something that somebody who is guilty of manslaughter, essentially, could do in ancient Israel. If they want to run away and get safety from potentially a brother or a kinsman who might avenge their kinsman of accidental death, they can go hang on the horns of the altar and be safe. But that was not Joab's crime. Joab was a murderer. And so Solomon said, I don't care if he's on the horns of the altar, you need to go kill him. And so Joab was killed. Abiathar was not killed. He was essentially exiled, and he was replaced. Shimei was not killed at first. Solomon said, you're going to live in this house, and if you ever leave the city, I will kill you. At some point, some of his servants get away. He goes and gets them and comes back, but he disobeyed Solomon, so he dies. Through these actions, Solomon kept there from being a civil war. Ultimately, three people died. Abiathar was never killed. But ultimately, three people died, and there was no revolt, and Solomon was able to take over. Now, Solomon had great wisdom. He asked God for wisdom, and God said, since you didn't ask for money or power, you asked for wisdom, I will give you great wisdom. And he did have great wisdom. And you know, a lot of what we generally call in the Old Testament the wisdom literature, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, a couple of the Psalms, and a lot of the Proverbs were written by Solomon. In the story, you remember the story of two ladies. They both have babies at basically the same time. They're in the same house. One of them lies on the child. It smothers it and dies, and then switches out the babies in the middle of the night. The other mother wakes up, realizes that one of the babies is dead, and then realizes it's not hers, and they bring this kerfuffle to Solomon. Solomon wisely says, okay, we don't know, so just cut the baby in half, and you guys can share it. Which, of course, is a ridiculous thing to do, but this is Solomon being wise, because then the mother that's the other mother is like, oh, good plan, I'll take half a baby. But the real mother of the child is no. You know, just take the baby. And Solomon goes, aha, you know, you're the real mother. And he resolves the issue. And his wisdom was so famous, he even got people from outside the kingdom come to see him, like the Queen of Sheba, who brought a lot of money and lots of questions to Solomon. So Solomon was known for his wisdom, at least at the early part of his life. Possibly the most important thing that Solomon did was the building of the temple. So turn to 1 Kings 8. Let's read this section here that I've got, 22 through 61. Think about the Deuteronomic curse and think about the covenant with David as we read this. Then Solomon stood before the altar of Yahweh in the presence all the assembly of Israel and spread out his hands towards heaven. This is after the temple has been built. He is dedicating it. And he said, O Yahweh, God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven above or on earth beneath, keeping covenant and showing steadfast love to your servants who walk before you with all their heart. Keeping covenant with whom? We've got the Abrahamic covenant in the past, we have the Mosaic covenant in the past, and we have the Davidic covenant now for a few years. You have kept with your servant David, my father, what you declared to him. You spoke with your mouth, and with your hand have fulfilled it this day. This is referring to a passage we read last time. Remember where David told God, that basically said, I'm going to build you a temple. And God said, no, you're not going to build me a temple. That's going to be your son. But I'm going to make this covenant with you. I will leave a descendant of yours on the throne forever. This is the Davidic covenant. This is what this is referring to. Now, therefore, O Yahweh, God of Israel, keep for your servant David, my father, what you have promised him, saying, you shall not lack a man to sit before me on the throne of Israel. If only your sons pay close attention to their way to walk before me as you have walked before me. And as we know from their history, they're going to have a problem with that. Now, therefore, O God of Israel, let your word be confirmed, which you have spoken to your servant David, my father. But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you. How much less this house that I have built? Yet have regard to the prayer of your servant and to his plea, O Yahweh, my God, listening to the cry and to the prayer that your servant prays before you this day, that your eyes may be open night and day toward this house, the place of which you have said, my name shall be there, that you may listen to the prayer that your servant offers towards this place, and listen to the plea of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray toward this place, and listen in heaven, your dwelling place, and when you hear, forgive. And you've got a number of paragraphs here of when we sin, God, please do this. Or when we turn, please, God, do this. And this is where the Deuteronomic curse comes in. Like, for example, verse 35. And when heaven is shut up and there is no rain because they have sinned against you, if they pray toward this place and acknowledge your name and turn from their sin, when you afflict them, then hear in heaven and forgive the sin of your servants, your people Israel, when you teach them the good way in which they should walk, and grant rain upon your land, which you have given to your people as an inheritance. Or, what covenant does this sound like? Verse 41. Likewise, when a foreigner who is not of your people Israel comes from a far country for your name's sake, for they shall hear of your great name and your mighty hand and your outstretched arm, when he comes and prays toward this house, hear in heaven your dwelling place, and do according to all for which the foreigner calls to you, in order that all the peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, and do as your people Israel, that they may know that this house that I have built is called by your name. So you'll probably recognize that from the Abrahamic covenant, where God said, through you I will bless all the Gentiles. And so what's going on in the Mosaic covenant and in the Davidic covenant is a tool for fulfilling the Abrahamic covenant. It doesn't replace the Abrahamic covenant, but it is a means by which that promise of Abraham could be fulfilled. Okay, that's essentially the idea. In the terms of the Mosaic covenant, if you obey me, then I will bless you. And that was, of course, a part of the covenant to Abraham and to David. If you and your sons obey me, I will bless you. And that's what Solomon's saying here. When the foreigners come in because they've heard of all the great things that are going on here, then bless them. It's later that we find out that the Mosaic covenant ultimately won't bring about that ultimate state of blessing. But that's future. And then in the last bit, 46 through the end of the dedication, he actually talks about exile, which is going to be happening to various Israelites in about 200 years. He actually talks about exile. We won't go through and read the whole passage just for time. And so in the dedication of the temple, Solomon is essentially recalling the covenants of the past. He's recalling the Abrahamic covenant. He's recalling the blessings and curses mentioned in the Mosaic covenant, and definitely recalling the covenant to his father, David. And ultimately saying, okay, you've put your name here, you've put your temple here, now please bless us. And when we sin, and you discipline us, then when we repent, please come back and bless us. So the temple. This will stand until 586 BC. And ultimately, well, we'll get there when we look at the timeline in a minute. Solomon was a really good king until he got old. You remember Solomon's problem. It wasn't so much that Solomon had lots of wives. Women aren't the problem. The problem was he had lots of foreign wives. That was the problem. As was fairly natural for kings, they're going to have A, lots of wives, and they're going to have B, lots of wives from other kings. Because what do you do? Well, you know, Solomon's really powerful. I don't want him to come kill me, so I will give him a daughter of mine in marriage to strengthen our alliances, not only for trade and things like that, but also if I need to go to war, and also so he won't come kill me. This is very, very normal for them to do that, for rulers to give their daughters to other kings to forge those alliances. And that, of course, happened forever, and I'm sure still happens today in some corners of the world. And so Solomon ultimately turns from God, not because he has so many wives, but because he has so many wives with foreign deities, and ultimately starts worshiping them. And that happens in 1 Kings 11. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh. That's quite far away. But Pharaoh, very, very powerful country. Pharaoh, a Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which Yahweh had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. And that's exactly what Solomon did. In many ways, Solomon fulfills a lot of what Samuel warned about kings. He said, if you get kings, what are they going to do? They're going to multiply, they're going to have lots of wives, and they're going to force you to do their work for you. And that's one thing that happens here in the king's narrative. Solomon, to build the temple and everything he wants to build, drafts Israelites and also non-Israelites into service. Now, God intended, because Samuel turned away, to discipline Israel. But he didn't do it during Solomon's lifetime. Not for Solomon's sake, but for David's. But right after Solomon died, when Solomon's son takes over, there is the people essentially come to that king, Rehoboam, and says, hey, your father was really tough on us. Could you please not make us work so much? And that king's like, well, what do I do? So he talks to some of his advisors, and the advisors are like, yeah, that's true, you should really stop. And some of the other advisors are like, well, it's weak people. You should be harder on them. And so he is harder on them, and there's a revolt, and the kingdom splits right after Solomon's death. So Solomon was a good king for a while, but then ultimately went bad. And so the kingdom right after Solomon splits, and that's what we'll be talking about in more detail soon. Okay, so that's essentially the overview of Solomon's life. So what's our next steps? We're going to divide the Old Testament literature into basically four chunks. Okay, the next one, even though it doesn't really carry forward the narrative very much, or at all, hardly, is we need to go ahead and stop now and talk about the wisdom literature. We'll probably spend a couple of weeks on this. I was thinking about doing just 1 week per section, but man, this is a lot to read, so, and a lot to overview. So I'm going to try to go for 2 weeks, and I'll get you readings per week, so we can try to keep up. It will be, if you want to read it all, a few hours of Bible reading to do it. But it will be something that can be done reasonably within a week, if you're so inclined. Wisdom literature is generally this. Job, no one knows who wrote it, and no one really knows what time period even takes. They say maybe it was written in the exilic period, but people, it sort of looks like he might live during Abraham's time. Who knows? Job, you probably know the story of Job. Job, greatly blessed, but then God tests his faith, and his whole life goes way down, and then at the very end, ultimately is blessed again by God. The Psalms, we read them every Sunday. These are the songs of the Bible. You've got Proverbs, not all of which were done by Solomon, though often they're called the Proverbs of Solomon, but he does contribute to some of them. Ecclesiastes, typically attributed to Solomon. If you read the book, this sounds like an old wise man looking back at life and going, it's not all roses, you know. It's not, there's something to be to eating, drinking, and being merry, because life is short and you die. Ecclesiastes. Song of Solomon is a book that has made many people over time very uncomfortable because it's essentially an erotic love poem between Solomon and his wife. Because this makes people uncomfortable, many Jews don't let kids read it till they're older, and many Christians have said, wait, we can't have this in our Bible. This is about Christ and the church, not about Solomon and one of his wives having sex. So that's the Song of Solomon. Maybe you want to spiritualize it, but this is a book essentially about sex. So that's the wisdom literature. You might recall Genesis was also mostly about that too. Not so much in the erotic sense, but in the sense of children. That's wisdom literature. We'll spend a couple weeks on that. Then stepping back into the timeline, we get to where the northern and the southern kingdoms are divided. So there is a rebellion. The north breaks away. Judah is in the south where Jerusalem is. And they maintain separate lives and often at enmity with one another until 722, when the northern kingdom is taken into exile by Assyria. These are the books probably written in that time. Well, 1 and 2 Kings, probably not, but that's the section of 1 and 2 Kings. People would generally put Chronicles actually having been written after the exile is over from Babylon, so this is way later. But those chapters cover this time period. This is up to the fall of the northern kingdom. You've got Jonah, because Jonah goes to Nineveh. Nineveh is the capital of Assyria, so that would make sense to put him in this time. You've got Micah, you've got Amos and Hosea, and then Isaiah 1 through 39. Now Isaiah, I'm going to, usually for all these prophets, we're going to put them within the time period that they wrote, regardless of when what they were talking about would come to pass. In most cases, they came to pass at that time. You got Amos, he's going to the northern kingdom saying, if you don't repent, you're going to fall. And sure enough, they did fall. Isaiah, we're going to go ahead and put in two sections, because even though Isaiah was in this time period, the second half of Isaiah, 40 through 66, which we spent a lot of time in, this is about either while they're in exile or after they are back from exile. So this will happen later. So Isaiah 1 through 39 would make sense to cover within this time period. Okay? So this is up until 722, when Assyria whoops up on the northern kingdom and does a lot of damage to the southern kingdom as well, but doesn't ultimately win, because God has them conquered by the Babylonians. And that's actually a subject matter of the prophets. So the next section would then be Judah, until it was taken over in roughly 586 by Babylon. This is 2 Chronicles and 2 Kings, and these are going to be your prophets. And so they take place, and you'll be able to see this a little bit better in a second when we look at the timeline. You'll see how these ultimately fit in within the timeline of the second temple. In the second kingdom, when just the southern kingdom is now surviving. But ultimately, they fall too. Because of their sin, God sends them into exile into Babylon. And so then you have our final section to finish out the Old Testament. And this is while they're under Babylonian and then Persian rule. Babylonians exile many of the people from Jerusalem and Judah to Babylon and to their land. Then Persia comes in and says, you may go back home. And not only may you go back home, you can rebuild your walls and you can rebuild your temple. And here's some money to do so. And so these books cover that. Ezra and Nehemiah. This was originally one book. Christians started separating this. I believe Origen was the first one. In the Hebrew scriptures themselves, they didn't start separating these into separate books until the Middle Ages. So those are you know, properly seen as really one book. But that's going to cover your history. Lamentations is a series of laments about the destruction of Jerusalem. Then you have Obadiah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Joel, no one knows where to put Joel. So this seems like a reasonable place because he mentions Greeks. So that's generally where a lot of people will put it. But it's hard to place Joel anywhere really within a time frame. Esther is a Jewish woman who becomes a queen during this time period. And then you have Isaiah 40 through 66, either as under Babylon or under Persia. Some of this stuff makes a little bit more sense within the context of a timeline. And so you've got Genesis before this point, but really up to whenever they go into Egypt. And you have about 400 years where nothing happens, at least in terms of literature. The Jews are in Egypt, growing in population until a point where you have the actual Exodus. So the period of the Exodus takes, you know, roughly 40 years. The book of Exodus doesn't take 40 years. It's a fairly short period of time, with Leviticus not really taking much time at all. The period of the Exodus is primarily narrated by the book of Numbers, which we've already gone through. And then Deuteronomy happens shortly before entering into the land. Deuteronomy recalls a lot of what happens in Numbers. But you can look at Deuteronomy as a series of big sermons right before they go into the land. Then you've got Joshua, and then you've got Judges. Now, the Old Testament chronology is incredibly difficult. They have two general ways of dating everything essentially up to this point. You've got the idea of an early or a late Exodus. If you have an early Exodus, that gives you about 400 years for the period of the Judges. If you have a late Exodus, you get about 200 years for the period of Judges. I don't really know. This would be a late Exodus. I really don't have any strong opinion on the matter. So then you have the period of Judges, which we've been through. You've got Ruth sometime within that period. We don't know when it was written because there's really nobody, if I can recall, any distinguishable markers of time. But people generally put Ruth within that period. It makes sense. Towards the end of the time of the Judges, you get Samuel. As you might recall, Samuel was the last judge. He, at least his sons in theory, would have been judges. But as it turns out, not really. So then you start getting the historical books that we have. So this top one, this one at the top is essentially time periods, and then you have books. So you have a period of a united kingdom where Saul, David, and Solomon are kings. And these are covered by essentially 1st and 2nd Samuel, Chronicles, and then starting in Kings. Now, 1st Chronicles covers the death of, it has a bunch of genealogies, so in that sense covers back to Adam. But really, in terms of its historical narrative, starts with the death of Saul and goes through Solomon for 1st Chronicles. And then 2nd Chronicles goes past 2nd Kings in terms of his history. This is not when 1st and 2nd Chronicles was written. Most people say they were both written over here, but this is the time period that they're covering. Okay, so during the time of the United Monarchy, we don't really get books being written much, unless you were going to say 1st and 2nd Samuel would be. But when you get to a divided kingdom, this is when you start getting your writing prophets. You've got prophets during the historical books, but they're not writing anything down, at least not that we have. When the kingdom splits, this is what that looks like. You've got roughly the same number of kings in the northern kingdom as you have in the south. The northern kingdom, though, dies faster because they are more sinful, and so God sends them into exile before. You've got a much more stable southern kingdom. It's not in great shape. They frequently have serious military problems, but in general, much more stable. Yes?
Can you move back to the top? The podium is blocked.
How about that? So here's your general outline. You've got, if I recall correctly, there's not a single good king up here. You've got a few scattered good kings in the southern kingdom that are faithful. They bring reforms about, but ultimately even the southern kingdom needs to fall. Now, during this time, this is when you start to get the writing prophets. And so, during the northern kingdom, you've got Amos and Micah and Jonah and Hosea all going towards the end of this kingdom. And then Isaiah. Isaiah is actually in the southern kingdom. but he starts writing at this time. These others are mostly concerned with the northern kingdom and their problems. And you've got like Amos, he's from the southern kingdom, but goes to the northern kingdom to preach against them. So here's your rough time period right here. In 722, which would be right here, this is when the northern kingdom falls to Assyria. Right in there. After the northern kingdom falls, all your activity naturally is going to be in the southern kingdom. So all of these prophets are happening right, really towards the end of even the southern kingdom. Ezekiel's prophecy is written while Ezekiel is in exile. When we get there, you'll read that Babylon came into Judah and did quite a bit of damage several times before ultimately destroying the temple. And so Ezekiel was taken away in an exile by Babylon before the final exile in 586. And so some of those were even written in exile. Lamentations is about Jerusalem. Jeremiah is getting ready for the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And you've got Daniel. Daniel is in exile. He is also one of the guys taken before the final conquest of the southern kingdom. And so in other words, this is a section to talk about. So you see why they're grouped that way. This is a section to talk about. This is a section to talk about. And then finally, you get this. This is after the southern kingdom has fallen.
So that's roughly 400 years after the temple was built.
So the temple, the basic idea is you've got Solomon here. His temple is going to be in the 900s, in the 10th century BC. You're going to have the temple destroyed 400 years later. Babylonians have to keep dealing with Israel and finally get tired of dealing with Israel and go and, you know, they take more and more drastic measures as they need to keep their vassal state in line, which at this point Israel had become. And really, they'd become a vassal state, and then some king thinks, hey, maybe we should get rid of this vassal status, and that does not go well for them. So your last stage, this is going to be after 586, you got the Babylonian captivity right here. It only lasts this long because the Persians come in and defeat the Babylonians. For the northern kingdom, they essentially lose. They have a real problem with losing their ethnic identity. One reason why would be they were in exile for a very long time. You're going to have some Jews who lived before, through, and after the Babylonian captivity. So they're not going to be taken away nearly as long out of the land. There just wasn't that much time until Persia came, Cyrus the Great came, and let them all go. So our primary history is written by Ezra and Nehemiah, that one book which is separated for us, and then you've got several different prophets, Isaiah 40 through 55, talking about exile, 56 through 66, post-exile, Malachi, Zechariah, Esther, all during this time period. Persia will stay in control for quite a while until you get Alexander the Great in the late 300s, this time frame. And at this point, we get into the intertestamental period, the time between the two testaments. The Apocrypha would be written during this period of time. And so, like, for example, 1 Maccabees is going to be very much concerned with this period because it's about the revolt of the Jews away from their Hellenistic rulers. And so you've got the Maccabean period. The Feast of Hanukkah that the Jews celebrate today is going back to that period of time when the Maccabees took Jerusalem back from the Greeks. In this case, it would be the Seleucid Empire. And reestablished the temple here. So now the temple was destroyed in 586. When Cyrus sends them back, they do rebuild their temple. And so the temple isn't actually gone for all that long. It's gone for, you know, a good generation or two, but it gets ultimately rebuilt. When you read literature about Judaism, you know, this has been, you know, the temple's going to be rebuilt right in here. This period, from this here all the way to AD 70, when the temple is destroyed by the general Titus of the Romans, that is called the Second Temple period. Okay? It's a convenient name, Second Temple, while the Second Temple was standing. That's a long period of time, and a lot happened. That's my warning that I need to wrap up. And so that's a very long period of time for the Jews to live, mostly under domination. There was a brief period of time where they weren't dominated by somebody, but all this time it's Babylon, it's Persia, it's Alexander, and then when his kingdom splits up, it's either the Ptolemies, which are based in Egypt, or the Seleucids, which are based in Persia. Then they get free, and then Rome comes in the first century BC, takes them over. Pompey, you might remember him, or Pompey, comes, takes them over, and then they're under the thumb of the Gentiles once again. So that's your rough time period. So we're going to take roughly 8-ish weeks to cover the wisdom literature, which I don't have on here because it doesn't really belong to a time. Partially because the Proverbs were written some by Solomon, but some by others, and some of those other people aren't dateable. So, you know, the Proverbs could have been compiled during this whole time. Who knows? Because you just can't date some of these people. So, wisdom literature, we'll talk about that. And then hopefully two weeks. And at that point, we will jump into the intertestamental period, and I'll give you some readings from the Maccabees and other books to read to take us in to get us ready for the New Testament. So, any questions about any of that? Yes.
Anyway.
Yes?
What do Jews do right now for sin? The temple is destroyed. There's no sacrifices happening.
So here's how ultimately they dealt with this. And this is something that was, obviously it's going to be a big deal while they're in Babylonian captivity. It's relieved whenever they get their temple back. But then whenever Rome destroys the temple in AD 70, it's a problem again. And so when you think of, you know, ancient Israel is going to be very different than what the Judaism that ultimately comes out of this. Because this is a long period of how do you deal with the fact that the Bible is talking about, the Bible in their perspective, you know, the Old Testament. It's talking about God blessing them, giving their land, and none of that's happening to them. They live in the land, but they're not winning. They're under Gentile rule. And so finally, when the temple gets destroyed, they have to deal with it. And the explanations I've seen, this is generally how they take it. And this is actually a fairly reasonable way to go if you need to come up with an answer. If you look at the prophets, there's a number of times in these prophets where we'll read, to obey is better than sacrifice. Right? Now, the prophets weren't saying, stop sacrificing and just obey God. They weren't saying that at all. They were, yes, you should be sacrificing all the time, but you should always be obeying too, because your sacrifices don't mean anything if you're not also obedient to God. But where they took this was, we don't have a temple. Well, then obedience is going to have to replace that, essentially. And also, so what you'll see in the rabbis is they will also take, you know, the reading and the study, the intense study of the Torah, as also a part of obedience and a replacement for temple sacrifice. So that's generally how I understand they take it. Because they're kind of stuck. Because as a Jew, you can't say, you know, or you're not supposed to, I'm just going to sacrifice over here at my house. You're not supposed to do that. That's quite forbidden. And when they did sacrifice in other places, God came down quite harshly on them for doing that. So they know they're not supposed to do that. So that is essentially where they went. So with the Judaism that came out of the Second Temple period, the rabbis shifted it more towards worship, shifted it really more towards study of the Torah and obedience as a replacement for sacrifice. Anything else about these time periods?
I often wonder what happened to the wisdom put into the Solomon.
You're right. How could the wisest man ever do that? But he did.
He enlisted foreigners to build the temple, and without groups of foreigners to intermarry with their women.
I have a comment about
that. Sure.
And we see it all the time in our own lives, but it's a scriptural principle, and that is, if God gives you light, wisdom, and you have that light, and you don't obey it, it is worse. The latter end is worse than the former. And that's why in 1 John, he says, walk in the light. And he says, if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, then we have fellowship one with another. And so Solomon had the commands of God not to marry all these foreign women. But he has these kings saying, take my daughter. Well, I guess I need to make this alliance. So he violates, he esteems the command of man above the command of God. He's directly disobedient to the light that he has. And in the condemnation of God, a lot of times, is just foolishness. I mean, those of us that are getting a little bit older now, you see a young person that is blessed with light, and then they go do crazy things, and then it's just more and more craziness. It's like the judgment is more confusion.
Yeah, I think it's important. Solomon, he didn't forget that it was unwise to marry one. He knew it was unwise. He just did it.
He just did it anyway.
He's also a good lesson of, from external, looking at Solomon externally, was Solomon successful? Solomon was more successful than David. When Solomon died, you had a lot of angry people, but you have a temple, you have a stronger military than Israel has ever had. It's looking good, but the reality is, it wasn't good. Externally, hey, I'm going to marry all these foreign wives. That's going to get me stronger, going to get Israel stronger. And on the outside, it did. But right after he died, it all fell apart.
And there's something there, too, because Solomon's like, he's not Nebuchadnezzar, but he could have walked along the wall and said, look at all this I've built. And how different is that from saying, I mean, there's nothing. There's not a temple. It's just God is the king. And we better find out what this rustic prophet, does he have a word from God?
It's a shame to squander that much wisdom. It's a good lesson for us. Any other thoughts, questions, or notes? The timeline? Right now it's an iPad app. I'll figure out how to do that. I'll screenshots, paste it together in Photoshop or something. I'll send it out. So, yes. Okay. I will.
Put a piece of paper, run through a copier.
Or I'll just take a picture with my phone and email you that. How about that? Yeah. So I will send you today. So I'll send you today updated notes. I will send you suggested readings for this section. We'll spend at least 2 weeks on this because Job is really long, as is Psalms is also really long. Anyway, I'll send you a reading list. We'll try to take this in 2 weeks. We can all do this. We can read this. It takes a few hours, but we can read this text. It'll be good. So I'll send that out today, updated notes, and I will also send you timeline until I can figure out how to publish this iPad app and make you buy an iPad, which I know would hurt you. Okay. All right, then. Let's be dismissed. Frank, will you pray for us?